All rise.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. We have a full house this morning. My notes tell me Edgewood High School students are here. If that's the case, would they please stand? Oh, my golly. Nice looking group. You may be seated. Two of my grandchildren go to Edgewood High School, but I don't see their smiling faces out there this morning. Okay, well, the students are here as part of a program we operate in coordination with the State Bar called Court with Class. And so they've had a little bit of an opportunity to know what you're going to talk about today. If the students can remain after the second argument this morning, Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who sits to my right, will come and chat with you a little bit about how matters get to the Supreme Court and some other procedural issues. So if you can stay, please do. Everyone is welcome. So the students, but anyone else who would like to stay, they are welcome as well. Are there any other high school students present this morning besides Edgewood? Okay, very good. So with those preliminaries out of the way, I'll call our first case for the day, State versus Scott. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Assistant State Public Defender Colleen Ball.
Okay. Sorry about that. We're using new mics, and yours wasn't working at the moment.
The light is now.
Okay.
I'm appearing on behalf of Petitioner Andre Scott. This appeal presents three issues for review, and I'd like to begin by thanking the Deputy Solicitor General for the many thoughtful concessions that he has made on at least two and a half of the three issues for review. I urge the court to accept the concessions because I think they will take us a long way toward reaching a just result on a very important issue.
We're all on the same page.
The first one is that we both agree that all of us have a significant constitutionally protected liberty interest in avoiding having the government force psychotropic medications into our bodies. We agree that this court's decision in State v. Deborah A.E. established a process for providing meaningful post-conviction relief to a person who is incompetent at the post-conviction stage. We agree that's the gold standard. Even the ABA endorses it. And we agree that Deborah A.E. directs the bench and the bar to Section 971.14 for guidance. We agree that when the circuit court enters an order for involuntary treatment or medication, that order should be immediately appealable, and we agree that if it isn't stayed pending that appeal, that in effect the defendant is denied an appeal. Now, I argue that that stay should be automatic, and the Deputy Solicitor General is, well, mostly they should be stayed. There's a little bit of wiggle room there we can talk about a little bit later, but we both agree that the stay is pretty important. Where we disagree is that we disagree about whether or not this court should tell the bench and the bar what the test is for treating a person to competency in the post-conviction context. And we may or may not disagree about what the test is or should be. And I think that's open because if you look at the Attorney General's briefs in the Court of Appeals, there, the argument was the test is, in the post-conviction context, the test is 971.14, and the AAG said, and if it isn't, then remand this case for application of cell. Here in this court, the Deputy Solicitor General has thus far not taken a position on the test.
Counsel, could you help me with Deborah A.E.? And what I'm interested in are the circumstances under which there may be an order for involuntary medication. So the way I understand Deborah A.E. is in the post-conviction setting, if the person is incompetent, you proceed with the post-conviction claims on which you don't need the defendant's competent input. You hold the rest or appoint a GAL to make the decisions the defendant would otherwise make. So if that's the formulation, under what circumstances would there ever be a need for an order to involuntarily medicate?
Your Honor, Deborah A.E. leaves that question open. Admittedly, it's going to be rare. It's also supposed to be very rare under cell at the trial court level. So it will be rare, and it's hard for me as the defense lawyer to tell the court, here's when it's okay, because as a defense lawyer, I'm always going to be taking the position that my client should not be treated to competency. So it's a little awkward, but Deborah A.E. doesn't close the door, and I'm not comfortable closing the door for the simple reason that we can't necessarily see all the possibilities that there might be on this issue.
Okay, let's look at it this way then. Are you aware of any Deborah A.E. compliant proceedings in which there was an order for involuntary medication?
I'm not, but Your Honor, you have to remember, Wisconsin has never recognized the right to appeal such an order, so there may have been plenty and people didn't know how to appeal them. That's kind of the problem we have with this case.
Well, we are in that situation, and that we're really not in Deborah A.E. Though it is post-conviction, we are beyond the facts of Deborah A.E. because she wasn't medicated. He's already been medicated involuntarily.
That's true.
So I think we have a different set of circumstances. My concern is a little bit different. As counsel for someone that you as an attorney believe post-conviction proceedings should be initiated, isn't it your obligation to let the court know that you are concerned about your client's ability to participate in the post-conviction proceedings?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I can't figure out from Deborah A.E., and I've read it four times, what are those things that would be no risk to the defendant? Here, I think he'd like a new trial. He thinks he got convicted of the wrong thing. Well, that is a certain amount of risk to the defendant.
That's right. It's not clear in this record what his precise goals are, but you raise an excellent point, Chief Justice Rogenczak. Here's what the situation looks like to the defense lawyer at the post-conviction stage, because right. I think unless we say what the test is, I'm in a very difficult ethical situation.
Right.
So we know from this record that this client wants post-conviction relief. We don't know exactly what because it hasn't been stated in the record yet, right? But the other thing we know is that he really does not want to be medicated. So my job as his lawyer is to understand what his objectives are. I now know two of them. And to craft a post-conviction strategy that will allow me to meet his goals. And so if we were to say, shoot, let's just remand this case and let it proceed without telling me and the bench, the bar, what that test is, I'm forced into a position where I have to say, here are my claims. And then the state could say, aha, this is one that requires treatment to medication. I need to know what the test is first. And it's the concern is even more immediate than that, Chief Justice Rogenczak. On Friday, I faxed a letter to the court, and I'm not entirely sure that the members of the court got it.
I haven't
okay.
seen it.
Attorney Berg is well aware of this. We've been communicating about it. The bailiff has the letter, but it's three sentences long. The court held a hearing in this case on Wednesday, or last Friday. The court does know that I moved for a competency exam because I filed that motion in December. On Friday, we know that an examining physician has found Mr. Scott not competent to proceed post-conviction again. And Judge Kremers has scheduled a hearing for April 3rd.
So apparently,
so we haven't had the hearing yet.
He was medicated, was deemed competent after a period of time, then stopped taking his medication. And I remember Judge Kremers saying, if you don't take your medication voluntarily and you become incompetent again, we're going to be right back here looking at a medication order, correct?
That's correct.
So that's where we are,
that
essentially.
That is where we are. Okay. And that is why it's so important that we have a test. And, Your Honor, I think the test is super easy. I really do.
For what?
The test for treatment with involuntary meds. It's not a big secret. The test is, I think, 971.14 with cell layered on top of it, Harper, Riggins, and cell layered on top. And you know what? The court doesn't have to look any further than its own mandatory circuit court form, CR-206, which is a combination of 971.14 and Harper, Riggins, and cell. If you look at your own form, it's incorporating all of those things. And so what would happen?
Who devised that form?
This court's Form Records Management Committee.
Okay. Yep. The court itself.
The court itself came up with this, and so I'm asking.
It's a committee.
An agency
not
the court.
Okay, the court's committee. The court's committee.
Right.
Fair
exactly.
enough. The court's committee. Yeah. Yeah. But this is what I'm trying to say is I don't think it is possible to. For any court before, during, or after trial to apply 971.14 to an involuntary medication order, just the plain language of it, and not violate substantive due process. That doesn't mean that what's in 971.14 has, you know, bad provisions in it. It has thoughtful provisions in it. It just doesn't incorporate, it wasn't updated to reflect Harper, Riggins, and Sell. So the test, it seems to me, should be the statute plus cell.
You know, there's another interest here that nobody talks about that bothers me a lot, particularly given Deborah A.E., which seems to say we'll just let these post-conviction rights sit out there for whatever time it takes for the defendant to decide he's going to be medicated or somehow competency returns, which could be 3, 4, 5 years. There's another interest here. It's the interest of the victims in finality. They have a constitutional right, just like the defendant has a constitutional right. Now, his right to post-conviction relief is statutory, correct? Nobody talks about their rights, and when you read Deborah A.E., they have none under that case. The victims can be without finality forevermore, and you could have a new trial in 6 years, according to Deborah A.E. There's got to be something else. Plus, cell is a trial. At the trial, the state is pushing. There's constitutional right to a defense and to effective assistance, which requires a defendant that can participate in his own defense. This, in the post-conviction stage, the defendant's in the driver's seat. He's pushing on this, not the state. The state's not making him do post-conviction relief. So I think there's an awful lot of stuff going on here that people aren't really putting together, and it causes me a tremendous concern.
Your Honor, the one thing the victims do have at the post-conviction stage is they have a conviction, and the person is serving time at that point. But I think their interests still are served. I think probably in the vast majority of appeals where competency becomes an issue, they're going to proceed without having to proceed and get resolved, okay?
I beg your pardon? I didn't understand what you just said.
I think, if I understand your concern, you want the appeal to go and be concluded, all claims to be concluded.
I think that the victims have an interest in having the matter finalized so that the defendant has gotten all of the statutory relief as well as the constitutional relief to which he was entitled. And I think Deborah A.E. leaves that last piece open indefinitely, which is contrary to the victim's rights to have finality so that there isn't a new trial in 3 or 4 years.
Well, there, for the most part, these cases can proceed through the appeal, and 974.06 is out there whether the person's competent or incompetent. But if we're going to proceed with the case on appeal and you get a reversal, then it's done. It's done like a normal appeal. I don't think we're talking about a large volume of cases here, Chief Justice Rogensack, in the post-conviction context. You could, if you wanted, when you were crafting the test for post-conviction, which I say is exactly the same pre-trial, mid-trial, and post-trial, you've got to show an essential and overriding government interest. Anytime there's an involuntary medication order, whether you are under Chapter 51 or the NGI statute or this statute, there has to be an essential and overriding government interest. That's number one. And then afterwards, it's a question of balancing the risks and the benefits of the medication. Well, under the essential and overriding government interest, at the trial level, you're looking at things like the seriousness of the crime and the facts of the individual case and whether the defendant had already been serving time, for example. In the post-conviction context, you would be looking at the seriousness of the crime, the facts of the individual case. Maybe that's a place to put in. Is there anything that the government needs to be worrying about with connection in respect to the victims? I would say from the defense end, what a factor I would consider when I'm trying to determine what the government's interest is I'd want to know, hey, has this defendant already served like 80 or 90% of his sentence? Because if he has, I don't think there's too much interest in medicating him, for example. Another factor I would consider, I would have in, you know, weigh in the government interest analysis is a point that opposing counsel mentioned. Do you actually, you know, need any information from the defendant in order to resolve the appeal? Because sometimes, Chief Justice, you can file a motion with bang up claims in them, like rock solid claims. They're major mistrial, terrible ineffective assistance of counsel or something. And the way these cases can be resolved is by a stipulation, you know, stipulated sentence credit, in which case you can end the appeal and you can also avoid the 974-06.
Those are not the cases that are bothering us, and that's not the case we have here today either.
No. Well, we don't know which case we have here. All we have is a notice of intent.
I think what we have here is someone that, when he is competent, wants to proceed post-conviction, but slides in and out of competency, and I think the court's unwilling to have post-conviction proceedings go forward with a defendant that's incompetent. At least that's where we are at the moment, correct?
I'm uncomfortable with it because I know that he doesn't want meds. So I'm trying to figure out, under what circumstances will this court impose meds? Because once you tell me that, then I will know what kinds of claims I can bring to meet one of his very dear objectives, avoiding medication.
Okay, fine.
To address and continue this line of questioning regarding finality, what role is the appointed temporary guardian to play? And how does that affect finality? I asked a question a bit rhetorically as to what role, because at least it is set out initially in Deborah A.E. The rules suggest the appointment of a temporary guardian to instruct defense counsel whether to initiate post-conviction relief, and if so, what objectives to seek. The attorney or the guardian is to make decisions that the law requires the defendant to make. When I read that, I have that guardian in the shoes of the defendant. It does two things. Number one, it certainly could lead to finality if what I read if I have a correct understanding of what I read. But also, it is, secondly, a bit of an anathema to have someone decide in the criminal case that's not the defendant, that on issues, on objectives that may implicate all sorts of rights. So could you address both? First of all, the finality, to continue with the questions just asked, and second, my pause about the role of this guardian.
Well, I thank you for bringing up the issue of the temporary guardian. I actually think that's very important. And so if point number one on any involuntary med test is, does the government have an essential and overriding interest, and you're asking yourself, what are the factors to consider, whether or not a temporary guardian has been appointed is definitely a factor, because so much can be accomplished while the defendant is incompetent if they have a person, a temporary guardian acting. For example, they could waive access to certain information that might be needed in order to put together a claim or that the court needs or something. They can make decisions, as you pointed out, a number of different decisions. So that, I think, goes a long way towards reaching finality in the vast majority of appeals, is having someone there acting on behalf of the defendant.
How is a guardian who looks after the best interests of the ward the proper person when you have adversary counsel who is to give the defendant the best defense that law will allow? I have a hard time with those concepts.
Your Honor, that was established in Lessard versus Schmidt out of Wisconsin that went up to the United States Supreme Court. There is a difference between a lawyer's role as an adversary counsel.
I understand the difference.
And then a person's role, a lawyer's role as a guardian. There are also different types of guardians. So what we're really talking about here is not a guardian ad litem.
It's a guardian of the person.
It's a temporary guardian. That's what we're talking about here. And the way those get appointed is that the circuit court will list, when they get appointed, what authority does this person have in this context,
okay.
And it's all limited.
Thank you.
And because of that, it actually would be extremely helpful to the lawyer who's trying very hard to protect the defendant's legal rights and their constitutional rights to have someone say, someone who's thinking like a defendant or like this defendant say, yes, I see those three claims. One of them involves a new trial, but if I have a new trial, that's going to risk a much higher sentence. So I don't want that one, but I really like these two other claims. Let's get him this kind of relief. I think the guardian can do that. A guardian could, for example, say, look, this guy's got bang-up claims. Get him out there, and let's see if we can force a settlement with the state. Let's bring him to the table. That's the kind of information that a guardian could give here. They would be looking out for the client's best legal interests and their constitutional interests. But me as a lawyer, I shouldn't be doing that. I need direction from somebody. And that's where I feel sort of in a little bit of an ethical quandary, unless and until we get a test that says what involuntary medication is.
Well, why doesn't this temporary guardian then relieve you of some of your angst?
Well, there isn't one right now, but hopefully there will be one.
That's the third prong of Deborah A.E.
Right.
And if
right.
You follow Deborah A.E.
I agree. I agree. I agree completely.
My goal is in part to make you happy and relieve your angst. And so, if you just follow Deborah A.E.,
yeah.
Why do you need more? Why do you need to superimpose, let me ask, cell onto Deborah A.E.?
Well, cell would be superimposed onto 971.14,
right.
But it's in the event, Your Honor, it's in the event that the subject of involuntary medication comes up, it's to protect the defendant's right to substantive due process, because the factors listed in cell have never been incorporated into 971.14.
If you're following Deborah A.E., however, where's the gateway to a cell analysis for involuntary medication? I mean, it seems, and pardon me for coming back to this, but it seems like Deborah A.E. covers the waterfront for post-conviction purposes and simply does not, and does it comprehensively enough that there's really no room there for an order to medicate a person back to competence.
Well, it leaves that question open, of course. It says that it ordinarily shouldn't be necessary, but it doesn't say it will never be necessary. If
right,
the state wants to concede it will never be necessary, we can stop right now.
Right, but shouldn't, before we walk through the gateway, shouldn't we define what it is?
Yep.
I mean, to figure out under what kind of circumstances that might be an issue?
I think we need to know what the test is, so that we can apply it to the facts when we encounter them.
This may be a chicken or egg problem, but before we can know what the test is, we have to know what the circumstances look like so we can figure out how to address them, don't we?
In general, Your Honor, I think the legislature and the courts declare the law, and then people conform their conduct to it. So we need to know what the law is so that we can decide.
Well, to that end, first a background question. Do you think instead of the order for involuntary administration of meds, do you think the circuit court should have ordered the appointment of a temporary guardian?
The lawyer who was representing the defendant at that point did not request one.
I know.
I think that is a good idea, yes.
And do you think that this is now getting back to Justice Kelly's question? And obviously this is a question on most of our minds too. How does the involuntary administrative meds, where is the doorway for that in the post-conviction scenario? And the discussion of the temporary guardian is one of them, because that we can all envision hypotheticals where only the defendant is going to have information that is going to be necessary for the advance of his or her case. And to have an incompetent defendant while the clock is running, well, days, months, weeks, are going by, and witnesses are leaving and dying and memories are fading. Could that be one of the triggering events where the temporary guardian, comes forward and makes a recommendation? Judge, I need to be able to talk to the defendant in a competent way, and so I am recommending the involuntary administration of meds.
I agree with you, Justice Gableman, that if there were a situation where you needed information from an incompetent defendant, that would be a factor to consider under determining whether or not the government has an interest in involuntarily medicating the defendant. That's probably going to be rare, but I agree that would be a factor to consider. I'd like to talk about that gateway real quickly, if I can. Here's how I see the big picture. You have Deborah A.E. Don't touch it. It covers most of the landscape, as you say, Justice Kelly. There are some things it doesn't cover. For example, it didn't cover the issue addressed in State v. Daniels, which was burden of proof. Well, we got that straightened out, so there's going to be little things here and there. And it doesn't give us a test for meds. I would leave Deborah A.E. exactly as is. It says, look, if you need guidance, pension bar, look to 971.14. And then if I were on the court, I would hold that the test for treatment to competency is 971.14 exactly as it is, with cell layered on top of it.
How do you layer it?
What?
You keep saying layer it. I want to know what the layer is.
The layer is the mandatory circuit court form. Basically, what it would go like this. You're in the post-conviction context, or you're in any context. This works pre-trial, trial, post-conviction. Doesn't matter. You have a person who is incompetent to proceed. The first question the judge wants to answer is the person dangerous? Because if they're dangerous, we get to medicate them, okay? But that's not an issue here. The second question is, okay, he's not dangerous. Now what do? We apply the cell analysis. And that's what your form says. The form includes a few other things with respect to the dangerous analysis, but on cell it says, look, is it necessary to significantly further an important government interest? That's what we've all been talking about right here. What's the government's interest at the post-conviction stage? Chief Justice Rogenczak, you identified the victims. Well, that's an important interest, and it could be considered right there. Are the medications substantially likely to render the defendant competent, it says here, to stand trial, change, proceed post-conviction? That's a great consideration. Is it substantially likely to have side effects that will undermine the fairness of the proceeding or his ability to assist counsel? It works post-conviction. Are there alternative, less intrusive ways to achieve the same result? We do that analysis all the time. Is it medically appropriate? That means if the person has schizophrenia, you can't treat them with a depression drug or something. It's got to be something, aimed towards that person's illness and not likely to cause them harm. The test is flexible, and it works in both settings. I think it will very, very rarely be used. However, If this court were to adopt what I just proposed, it would clear up a big mess in the circuit courts because the circuit courts are not applying 971.14 correctly.
Thank you.
Luke Berg, on behalf of the state, may it please the court. As you know, the state has conceded all three of the major issues in this case. The only disagreement that we have is how far this court should go. So to explain the disagreement, I'll go through each of the three issues in turn and explain where we disagree. So the first and major issue in the case is whether the medication order was unlawful. Now, Scott had two alternate arguments for why it wasn't lawful. First, he argued that the order violated state law, namely Debra A.E., which the state has conceded. And second, that the order was unconstitutional.
You think it violated Debra A.E.? Debra A.E., there was not, that issue never came up.
Debra
A.E. There was no medication order in Debra A.E., so how could the courts issuing a medication order in this case violate Debra A.E.?
That's correct. Debra A.E. created a very specific set of procedures.
But it was a circumstance before a medication order had come about. So there's nothing in Debra A.E. that says this court's medication order violated his rights.
That's true, but...
Then why'd you concede the issue?
Because Debra A.E. created a very specific set of procedures to follow when a defendant becomes incompetent in post-conviction proceedings and said, if you follow these procedures, ordinarily medication will be unnecessary. And in this case, the circuit court ordered medication without following those procedures or without any reason to think that those procedures would be insufficient. So we believe, the state believes, that the procedures that Debra E. created are good, they're right, they're the right procedures to follow, and they are sufficient in general to protect both the defendant's interest in meaningful post-conviction relief.
So
I assume that, can I just finish just a second, Justice Gableman? I assume then, on the hearing that's going to occur April 3rd, it's a little bit of a waste of time because the state is not going to argue he should be medicated, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so there's really no need to have that hearing. That's the state's position.
Well, the hearing is on his competency.
Yeah, well, right.
That's the initial step of Debra A.E., and the competency determination is important for three reasons Debra A.E. said, one of which is it authorizes the appointment of a guardian.
Right.
But it also marks in time.
But there's not going to be any request for medication. I just want to be clear on where you are.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Thank you.
What should the circuit court have done at the hearing rather than order the involuntary administration of medication?
Well, I think the circuit court should have waited to see what the claims are. And that's why the order was premature. That's why we used the word premature in our briefing. So if defense counsel reviewed the record and thought the only promising claims in the case involve no risk to the defendant, then the appeal can proceed as normal, and there's nothing to be done. The appeal just goes forward.
There's a request for a new trial.
Sure. If there's a request for a new trial or something that involves some risk to the defendant, then the court should have appointed a temporary guardian.
But what kind of claims could be made that have no risk to the defendant?
A double jeopardy claim, for example, or let's say the entire case.
You have a double jeopardy claim, don't you end up with a new trial, or what do you end up with?
Well, if the double jeopardy claim was that the charge couldn't be brought because it had already been brought, then the whole thing would go away.
Gotcha. Okay.
Or, for example, if the entire case hinged on a confession and the claim was that the confession was coerced and it's very clear that it's coerced and it's clear that the state will have no evidence with which to convict, and so there won't be a retrial. I think there's certain circumstances where there would be no risk.
So at a certain point when Ms. Ball was making her presentation and it got highlighted during her discussion with Justice Kelly, there came a point where there seemed to be an avenue yet undefined where in a post-conviction proceeding there seems to be a pathway for the involuntary administration of psychotropic medications, as yet undefined.
That's right.
What is your view on that?
So our view is that there are two potential circumstances where involuntary medication might be appropriate in the post-conviction context. One is if defense counsel can look on the record and find a promising claim that would depend on the defendant's competency, then medication might actually be warranted on the defendant's behalf.
What would be an example of that?
If there was an indication on the record that there was a significant piece of exculpatory evidence that the defendant mentioned to his lawyer and the lawyer didn't present that or something, it'd be an ineffective assistance of counsel type claim. But we would need to consult with the defendant to know exactly what that conversation was.
An alibi or something.
Right, yes, something like that. So that's one way where medication might be appropriate on the defendant's behalf. The other way is if there is an especially, the state has an especially strong interest in finality.
But is that something, though, you said the defense lawyer would have to raise it. Is that something, though, that the temporary guardian would also have to sign? I mean, where are you pulling your procedures from? Where are you pulling this from?
Well, from Deborah A. So I think if there is...
So would the temporary, according to that, would the temporary guardian have to agree to that as well?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah,
so please proceed.
So
we're about to say the second scenario. You said there were two, you named one.
Yeah, so the second scenario is if in some case the state had an especially strong need for finality.
Yeah.
So if there was an especial need for closure for the victims, for example, if it's an especially egregious crime or if evidence was about to go stale or something, it might be worth medicating the defendant to ensure that there are no outstanding claims in order to achieve finality.
I can envision, we can all envision an especially egregious crime, evidence that's about to go stale. Give me an example.
So you have a murder and the primary evidence is a particular witness who has cancer, they're on their deathbed, they're going to die in the next 5 years. We want to prevent any sort of future outstanding post-conviction claim that wouldn't allow the state to retry the defendant because now the witness is dead and can't testify or something like that.
Okay.
So those are two possible scenarios where involuntary medication would be appropriate. Maybe. Neither of those is presented here, and so all we're asking this court to hold is that medication is inappropriate when there is no reason to think that Deborah A.E.'s procedures will be insufficient.
How long would you have Deborah A.E. stay open? How many years? And this man's had mental difficulties for a long time.
I'm not sure I totally understand the question.
The question is, how long? Deborah A.E. doesn't have any time limit at all on just putting aside and letting these post-conviction possible motions and rights float. There's no time limit. Do you
that's
have
right,
a time limit?
Right. So under Deborah A.E., the vast majority of post-conviction claims can be brought immediately, either through counsel's efforts alone or in combination with a temporary guardian. The only claims that are outstanding indefinitely, and they are indefinite,
right,
are the claims that involve the defendant's memory or actually require them to be competent to develop that claim. I think Deborah A.E. Held, and I think reasonably, that those claims should stand out there indefinitely because you have the countervailing constitutional interest that the defendant has in not being medicated.
But how do you balance that with the concern that the Chief Justice has voiced from the beginning of this argument about if you have a case where there is a real need for finality for the victims, and I think we could all envision those scenarios, you kind of characterized it as invoking Rumsfeld, the unknown unknowns. There's always the possibility of the existence of unknown unknowns, and arguably couldn't the state at every one of these hearings make the argument that there's a strong interest in finality for the victims, and so we should medicate the defendant to find out what those, or to uncover those unknown unknowns.
Right.
Yeah, that is a possible argument, but that would be equivalent to overruling Deborah A.E., and what that would mean is that in every single one of these cases, defendants would be medicated every single time. And I think Deborah A.E. tried to balance that potential against the defendant's strong interest in not being forcibly medicated.
I didn't read the word victim in Deborah A.E. Did you read the word victim in Deborah A.E.?
No.
I didn't read it in anybody's briefs either.
It was in our brief.
Was it?
At page
okay.
19, yeah.
Good. Thank you. I missed it.
Yeah. One of the reasons we suggested that the court might want to medicate in the post-conviction context is if there's a strong need for closure for victims, and we want to ensure that there's no outstanding claims. I think that could justify post-medication in some context.
One facet of this case that we have not discussed before, and I will invite Ms. Ball's comment because I'd like to hear it on her rebuttal, and I'd like to get your take on this, is the circuit court, the whole impetus behind his reasoning for ordering the medication was his view of the perversity of having an incompetent incarcerated in our prison system.
Right.
And there is something intuitively problematic about that. And you just made reference to, well, gee, you know, you could do that if you wanted to overrule Deborah A. But I thought to myself when I read Judge Kremer's reasoning, I thought to myself, well, there's a lot of sense there. There is a lot of sense that, it does seem to be disconcerting to knowingly have incompetent people incarcerated in our prisons, and despite the best efforts of the people who are charged with their not only guarding them, but you know, and making sure they, but also protecting them and their well-being, that they are subject to certain victimization. And doesn't the state have an interest there? And doesn't their wouldn't if they had a guardian, wouldn't the guardian have an interest in protecting them from that? What do you say to that?
Absolutely, the state has very specific facilities to deal with mentally incompetent defendants who are in prison. They transfer to facilities that are specifically designed more as treatment facilities than as incarceration.
Okay.
So the Wisconsin Resource Center up in Winnebago is where
yeah.
Scott is currently housed,
right.
Where a lot of mentally incompetent defendants are housed. And it's a lot less restrictive. It's more focused on treatment and less on incarceration. But the fact remains, Scott committed a crime. He was convicted when he was incompetent, and so the state has an interest in keeping society safe from that happening again, and so it keeps him confined, but in a treatment center. I'm not aware of any constitutional claim that the state cannot keep someone incarcerated who is incompetent. That hasn't been raised in this case, and I'm not aware that is true.
What's wrong with your opposing counsel's suggestion? As I understand it, you want us to stop at Deborah A.E. in our analysis, in large part, say there was a violation, and embrace a constitutional avoidance, as I understand your argument. One of my concerns is that this kind of situation can arise on a regular basis in courthouses throughout the state. And aren't we somewhat shirking our job if we don't provide additional guidance for the case that's going to be next week in the eastern part of the state and one in the western part of the state? I mean, that issue is there. What to do with cell and 971 point, whatever the point is, 14.4B.
So I haven't gotten there yet in my argument, but I was going to give you three reasons why you shouldn't reach the constitutional issue in this case, but the third reason directly answers your question, which is that this issue may never come up, and if Deborah A.E. is properly followed, it probably will never come up. So this case that you're hearing right now is the first case that I'm aware of in the 25 years since Deborah A.E. that the state has ever even tried to forcibly medicate somebody to competence in the post-conviction context. And the reason is the state just doesn't have an interest in doing so most of the time because the person is in prison, they've been convicted, and they will stay there until either their sentence completes or they have a successful appeal. The state has no interest in medicating the person because it believes that the procedures Deborah A. created are sufficient to ensure finality in the vast majority of cases. So this case is the only case I'm aware of in the state. I'm aware of only one other case in the entire country where the state has ever even tried to medicate somebody. So the fact that this issue, the constitutional issue, may never come up is a reason not to decide it. Another reason not to decide it is that it is not a straightforward constitutional question. Now, Scott is asking you to apply Sell in the post-conviction context, but Sell was very clear that the rule that it announced applied only to a specific purpose, the purpose of medicating somebody to competence in order to stand trial. The context here is very different. So pretrial, forced medication is against defendants' legal interests. It allows them to be brought to trial. They typically don't want that. Post-conviction, forced medication actually furthers defendants' legal interests because it increases their chances on appeal, and the appeal is entirely for their benefit. So if there were a case, not this case, but if there were a case where the state actually had an interest in medicating the defendant in post-conviction proceedings, the state's interests and at least one of the defendant's interests would be aligned. And so arguably, the burden on the state should be lower than it should be in the pretrial context.
I always get a little nervous when someone tells me what's in my best interest.
Right, absolutely.
Probably all the students do too, right? So you've outlined the best interest and the reason for the interests are different vis-a-vis post-conviction and pre-conviction. I mean, one of the interests is to have your body be free from interference by the government. Another interest is to be free from very difficult side effects. So you've picked one interest, but there are other interests.
Absolutely. I agree with I was trying to choose my language very carefully to make sure that I was only talking about one interest. Mm-hmm. And the only interest I was talking about was the defendant's legal interest. But you're absolutely right that the defendant has an interest in not being forcibly medicated, and that interest goes counter to the defendant's legal interest.
My question digs a little deeper. I didn't voice that. I really wonder if there's much of a difference in terms of analysis between the pre-conviction and post-conviction vis-a-vis the application of Sell.
The defendant's interest in not being medicated obviously is the same, but the defendant's legal interests are different.
Mm-hmm.
So pretrial, the defendant's legal interest is not to be medicated because it doesn't want to be brought to trial. Post-conviction, the legal interest is actually benefits the defendant to be medicated. And that different context, I think, could warrant, we're not saying it does necessarily, but it could warrant a lower standard on the government. Now, the only case that I found in the country that actually considered this question said exactly that. It said, we question whether Sell should apply in this context because arguably the state's interests and the defendant's interests are aligned in this way. Obviously, the defendant still has an interest in not being medicated. So we're not asking this court to adopt any particular standard. I want to be very clear about that. The point is just this is not necessarily a straightforward application of Sell. And so the fact that it's somewhat of a difficult constitutional question and a question that may never arise if you properly apply Deborah A.E., those are two strong reasons why you shouldn't reach the constitutional
question.
Well,
it sounds like it's not going to apply here because you're going to go back for the competency hearing, and if he's determined to be incompetent, which I take from Attorney Ball's letter, that's probably what will occur, he won't be medicated.
That's right.
Again.
That's right.
And any claims that he has that are post-conviction claims are just going to float ad infinitum, right?
Well, no. The vast majority of the claims will proceed. Any claims that involve no risk to Scott.
Well, he thinks he was convicted of the wrong thing. He thinks he should have been convicted of something that would have given him a lesser sentence, correct?
Right.
So
right.
He won't have that opportunity. Or do you think he can go forward with that claim even if he's incompetent?
That claim, if the factual basis for the claims are record-based, but they involve some risk because it would involve a new trial, then
right.
What will happen is the court will appoint a guardian for Scott to make the decision whether those claims should proceed or not, whether the risk is worth it to Scott. So
What about the victim? Isn't this an assaultive crime? He says he's not dangerous, but he was sure dangerous to the person that he beat up or whatever he did to the person that put him in prison.
Right. So from the victim's point of view, all potential appellate claims will proceed in the case, either through counsel's efforts alone or with the temporary guardian. The only claims that will be outstanding in the ether, stuck in limbo, are the claims that require his memory, his mind, and we can't get to those claims because we need his memory. I think the intuition in Deborah A.E., and I agree with it, is that that group of claims is a small subset of the total appellate claims, and so although there is some risk to finality, that risk doesn't outweigh the significant countervailing interest that defendants have in not being forcibly medicated. That's the rationale, I think, of Deborah A.E.
I think that's the rationale of Deborah A.E., and if you focus on the defendant, I don't have any problems with it. I have real concerns, obviously, with finality for the victims. And if we let this go on, because you can't have a new trial, and 5 years down the road, whatever happens, his medical condition changes enough that he regains competency, he has then, under Deborah A.E. and the decision you're agreeing we should write, the ability to proceed on those.
The state's position is that the finality interest and the interest of victims is adequately protected because most claims will go forward on appeal.
But this victim is only concerned about this claim. Just like this defendant is only concerned about this medication. I mean, when you get down to it, it's quite personal.
I think we might be talking over each other in terms of claims. There are multiple possible appellate issues in this one case.
I understand that.
Okay.
So I understand that. My concern is really with those issues. You phrase them as the issues involving the defendant's mental cooperation, and I understand that. But one of them would be a new trial, correct?
Sure.
Okay. So my concern is with the person that was assaulted, that ended up having, Mr. Scott put in prison because of what occurred. 5 years down the road, whatever happens, and his mental condition changes such that he regains competency, and he wants a new trial. Under Deborah A.E., he gets it, and I understand that you agree he would get it as well.
No.
Okay, well, then I'm missing something.
Yeah, so if there is a claim that is purely record-based right now,
mm-hmm.
and the reason it's hard to bring is because it involves some risk to the defendant,
mm-hmm.
that claim will either go forward now or not, depending on what a guardian decides.
Okay.
That can't be brought in the future, because it could have been brought now if the guardian decided.
Right.
So the only claims that can be brought in the future are the ones that require his mind.
Like a new trial.
No, the new trial, I think a claim that involves a new trial doesn't necessarily require his mind to develop the factual foundation for the claim. The only reason it requires his mind is to make the decision whether to pursue that risk, but that's what the guardian does. So when you have a guardian, the guardian makes the decision about the risk.
Okay.
So those new trial type claims, the vast majority of those will be resolved now using a guardian. The only ones that will be outstanding is this small subset. And
the guardian can decide, you believe, for Mr. Scott, whether he should have adversary counsel, proceed for a new trial, and then, of course, if he's convicted, a new sentencing, which may be significantly more than what he already got.
Yes, I think that's I think
really?
The guardian can decide.
Wow, okay.
I mean, the alternative to a guardian deciding that is forcibly medicating him. So which is better from his perspective? He doesn't want to be medicated.
No.
Or somebody has to decide for him whether these risks are worth taking. I think you have to pick one of those two.
Okay.
And I think Deborah A. landed on the side of a guardian making those decisions, and I think that's right.
Okay.
This may help your concern as well, but I just want to point out that Scott is 8 years into a 13-year incarceration. So
right.
This is not a case where he's in prison for 30 years and 20 years from now these could be brought up.
Right.
5 years from now he's going to get out. It'll be on extended supervision. He's got 10 years of that. But he's going to get out in 5 years anyway. And so that's one of the reasons we didn't raise a finality argument or a victim-based argument in this particular case,
mm-hmm.
because he's that far into it.
Right, sentence. But I agree with opposing counsel that what the circuit courts need are clarity to the degree that we can provide that to them through this decision.
Absolutely.
Okay, and somebody may be there for 30 years and be very happy to have a new trial 5 years after they were first determined incompetent.
And I think the clarity that this court should provide is to say you cannot involuntarily medicate somebody in the post-conviction context unless you have a really good reason to believe that Deborah A's procedures will be insufficient to protect either the defendant's interest in post-conviction relief or the state's interest in finality, including the victim's need for closure, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Since we don't have either of those here, this order was invalid.
Okay.
We'll leave for a future case where that argument arises to define the boundaries precisely of when involuntary medication might be appropriate. But you can say broadly, you need some reason to believe that Deborah A. is insufficient. We just don't have that here.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. That was very helpful.
I'd like to shift gears and talk about the second issue, which we haven't had a moment to talk about yet. There is an area of agreement and an area of disagreement on this issue. The state does agree that involuntary medication orders should be immediately appealable, agreeing that the harm done to the defendant by forced medication cannot be undone. But the disagreement arises when you're looking at which statute to apply to make these orders immediately appealable. And the state's taking the position that we should apply the permissive appeal statute. And basically, if I'm understanding your argument, you're asking us to rewrite the language of the statute from May to Shell when it comes to these orders. So I guess my question for you is, why not construe a competency proceeding to be a special proceeding and make it an appeal as of right? I understand Elger appears to present a block to this, but that was a Chapter 980 case, which I think is different because the issues are substantively the same when the defendant is petitioning for the commitment order to end, but we also have the older Voss case where we could construe this proceeding to be merely connected with the underlying trial issues. And here, the post-conviction process was actually suspended, so can't we view the competency proceedings to be special proceedings?
Yes, you've summarized my position better than I could have. So we do not object at all to this court holding it to be a final order in a special proceeding. The only complication, as you identified, is this court's language in Alger. So this court discussed what are special proceedings. Now, some of that language could support finding competency proceedings to be a special proceeding, but a lot of it suggests that they are not. So this court would have to clarify what is a special proceeding, and we have no objection to that whatsoever. The only reason we propose the alternate route is we think it's clearer legal basis because sub 2B permissive appeal allows an appeal that would cause irreparable injury, and clearly there's potential irreparable injury. But I grant you it's weird for this court to order the Court of Appeals to grant appeals in every one of these cases.
Weird or statutorily wrong?
Well, this court has done that in a prior case. In Arneson v. Jeswinski, the court did exactly that. And the issue in that case was the denial of a qualified immunity claim, of a motion to dismiss for qualified immunity grounds. And this court held that that has to be appealable for the same reasons I'm suggesting now, which is that qualified immunity protects state officials from having to defend the merits of the claim. And if they can't appeal the denial until after they defend the merits of the claim, then the right is lost. And the court concluded that that couldn't be a final order in a special proceeding, so instead it ordered the Court of Appeals to grant permissive appeals in every case because the standard will always be met. So there's precedent for it, but I grant you it is a little bit strange. So either way, we're fine with either route. We just wanted to propose two alternatives to aid this court in deciding how to reach what we think is clearly the right answer on that issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Berg, when last you and the Chief Justice were talking about the procedures of Deborah A.E., the way you finished up, the way you both finished up was on an accord that if you follow Deborah A.E., most of the claims are going to be able to be resolved. There will be finality. And then You said there will only be a small subset of claims that if he were to regain competency. Now, let's assume instead of a 13-year initial term of confinement, let's say it's a 30-year. And what would be an example? Say he did regain competency in 10 years.
Right.
What would be an example of one of the small subsets of claims that between the defense attorney and the guardian, temporary guardian, do you suppose that if he regained his competency, wouldn't have been able to be litigated?
So there's probably more than I was able to think of. The example that I was able to come up with was an ineffective assistance of counsel type claim. So let's say 10 years from now, he becomes competent and he suddenly tells his appellate counsel, gee, I presented to my trial counsel all of this following evidence which would show that I'm innocent, and my counsel ignored me and didn't present any of it. Or I had a significant witness that I told my counsel about, and he refused to call the witness for some reason. That sort of thing that appellate counsel would be unaware of by reviewing the record, but would only become aware of by talking to the defendant. So that's an example.
Thanks.
So unless there are further questions, I will sit down at this point. We would ask you to hold only that the order violated Debra A.E. and not decide the constitutional question, and to hold that the order is immediately appealable, either as of right, or order the Court of Appeals to grant permissive appeals, and to hold that it should be stayed for the same reason that it should be immediately appealable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Quickly, just a couple of things. First, Chief Justice, to your question of will meds be ordered on April 3rd, the Deputy Solicitor General does not represent the state of Wisconsin in the circuit court. The ADA who will be appearing is one who said that he would be wanting Mr. Scott to stay on meds through the course of the proceeding. Now, maybe they will talk and he will back off that position, but the circuit court, of course, can do whatever the circuit court wants. So it's a possibility. I'm not saying it's going to happen. If it comes up and we can't resolve it, obviously I'll come here for a stay. But hopefully we won't reach that point. But I'm saying, you know, this issue is ripe for a test. It's ripe for a test for that reason. It's also ripe for a test because of the position that lawyers and clients are in when they're trying to decide the defendant's post-conviction strategy. We need to know when involuntary medications might be a possibility in order to craft and decide which claims to bring. There could be claims that this court or the circuit court might never see if I thought they entailed the risk of medication. So,
are you going to appear for the defendant at the hearing?
Or excuse me?
Will you appear?
Yes, I will.
Oh, because usually you're appellate counsel.
But this is at the post-conviction stage.
So same right. Thing. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
So I will.
Thank
so
you.
That was one point I wanted to address. A second point, Justice Gableman, you had mentioned Judge Kremer's concern about the inhumanity of leaving a person who's mentally ill in prison. I respect very much Judge Kremer's concern about that. I think that speaks very well of him. But the fact of the matter is, under United States Supreme Court precedent, and it's Addington versus Texas, O'Connor versus Donaldson, it's Harper versus Washington, and you can just look at our own statute 51611G, that's Wisconsin's Patients' Rights Act. Just because someone's mentally ill does not mean we get to medicate them. If they have to be, at a minimum, dangerous, too.
And the other question I had was raised by my last question to Mr. Berg, is do you agree, and when he was discussing the rights that an incompetent prisoner could raise upon regaining competency, when he was discussing that with the Chief Justice, I was reading along in your brief at page 12, and I thought it was a very finely crafted phrase that you used, where you went through the procedures of Debra A.E. at pages 11 and 12. And at the top of page 12, you say, if Scott regains competency after his direct appeal is over, then he should be permitted to raise issues that, and here's the phrase, that he was unable to raise earlier due to his incompetence. Now, read in its broadest terms, that could really be everything. But do you agree with Mr. Berg's understanding of what would be left for Mr. Scott to litigate upon regaining competency?
I think it would be a very small number of claims, if any. Yeah. I mean, let's look at it from the defense perspective. We want to get the appeal litigated. We want to get relief for our client. So we're going to try and put the best case forward that we can, everything that we can. And if we don't know about it, I mean, there's not much we can do, right?
Sure.
Right. So we want the appeal resolved. We want to push it forward.
Do you agree with him that ineffective assistance of counsel would be a good example of one such claim?
Not every ineffective assistance of counsel claim. There will be many of them that don't require the defendant's memory, but some
sure.
might.
There could be one on the record. You know, there could be
for sure. Exactly. But failure to object. That doesn't require any interaction
true.
With the defendant.
But the one that he used in particular was, gee, I told my lawyer about all this exculpatory evidence, and he never brought it up. And there was no record. Well, he didn't add this, but I'm adding this part. There was no record. There was no paper trail. And you only know about this now because I regained my competency 20 years after the fact.
Yeah. And you have to remember something, Justice Gableman. When someone...
I'm not trying to argue
no,
with
no,
you.
No, no, no. I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
Do you agree that that would be one such example?
It might be. It might be.
Okay. Can you think of another?
Of where meds might or where a claim might come up later.
Right.
Okay. Yes. And here's the thing. The most important thing in this analysis is to stop asking if it's in the defendant's interest to be medicated post-conviction because this is an involuntary med order. The question is it in the government's interest to have somebody medicated? And so an example might be, I don't want to have this quoted back at me in the event I'm representing this defendant next week, but might be, let's say that there is a defendant who has committed a violent crime spree, and what we find out some years down the road during the middle of the direct appeal is that the state has the wrong guy, and the only way they're going to be able to prove they have the wrong guy is they need to talk to the defendant. Meanwhile, you've got somebody out there that's creating havoc in the public. Well, in that case, maybe it would make the state would seem to have an interest potentially in medicating the defendant to get whatever information it needs in order to resolve the matter, protect the public, that sort of thing. Please don't
great
quote
example.
Me. Please don't quote
well,
because I'll have that defendant.
That seems like a perfect example.
Okay. Thank you.
Your Honor,
one sentence and then you really need to conclude.
This court can clear up a huge mess in the circuit courts at the trial level because people do not understand that some dots need to be connected, the dots between Harper, Riggins, and Sell, which we're all bound by, 971.14, which is still on the books, and then our mandatory circuit court form. Okay? There's confusion. The courts are at no stage of proceedings are finding this correctly, and if you simply hold that the test for treatment to competency is a cell layered on top of 971.14. It can be the same test at all three stages. You don't have to overrule Deborah A.E., and you don't have to modify the form. And
what is the form number that you keep referring to?
CR-206.
206. Okay. Thank you very much. Well, thank you for wonderful arguments. You both did just a terrific job. It's a very, very interesting case, so thank you so much. We are going to take a break now so that other counsel can come in. Some of the students will leave and others will join us, and we'll be back in a little bit for our second case. We are adjourned.